At a German medical conference in Karlsruhe in 1921, a proposal was put forward for the legalization of euthanasia but was rejected. At a psychiatric congress in Dresden in 1922, the same motion and report that had been presented in Karlsruhe was brought up and again rejected. At about the same time, the Monist League, one of its founders was Ernst Haeckel, convinced supporter of social Darwinism, made a similar suggestion to the Reichstag, again without success. In the USA, Dr. Alexis Carrel, C-A-R-R-E-L, a French-American Nobel Prize winner who has been on the staff of the Rockefeller Institute since its inception, published his book, Man the Unknown, in 1935. Its message cannot be said to have been limited to home consumption, for within 3 years it had been translated into 9 other languages. In his last chapter, The Remaking of Man, Carrel repeatedly looked to eugenics as the solution to the ills of society. He suggests the removal of the mentally ill and the criminal by small euthanasia institutions which were to be equipped with suitable gases. Now, bear in mind, this is a French-American in 1935. This is not a Nazi. Repeating again. In his last chapter, The Remaking of Man, Carrel repeatedly looks to eugenics as the solution to the ills of society. He suggests the removal of the mentally ill and the criminal by small euthanasia institutions which were to be equipped with suitable gases. Quote, there remains the unsolved problem of the immense number of defectives and criminals. They are an enormous burden for the part of the population that has remained normal. As already pointed out, gigantic sums are now required to maintain prisons and insane asylums and protect the public against gangsters and lunatics. Why do we preserve these useless and harmful beings? The abnormal prevent the development of the normal. This fact must be squarely faced. Why should society not dispose of the criminals and the insane in a more economical manner? Why should society not dispose of the criminals and the insane in a more economical manner? We cannot go on trying to separate the responsible from the irresponsible, punish the guilty, spare those who, although having committed a crime, are thought to be morally innocent. We are not capable of judging men. However, the community must be protected against troublesome and dangerous elements. How can this be done? Certainly not by building larger and more comfortable prisons, just as real health will not be promoted by larger and more scientific hospitals. In Germany, the government has taken energetic measures against the multiplication of inferior types, the insane, and criminals. The ideal solution would be to eliminate all such individuals as soon as they prove dangerous. Criminality and insanity can be prevented only by a better knowledge of man, by eugenics, by changes in education and in social conditions. Meanwhile, criminals have to be dealt with effectively. Perhaps prisons should be abolished. They could be replaced by smaller and less expensive institutions. The conditioning of petty criminals with the whip or some more scientific procedure, followed by a short stay in hospital, would probably suffice to ensure order. Those who have murdered, robbed while armed with automatic pistol or machine gun, kidnapped children, despoiled the poor of their savings, misled the public in important matters, should be humanely and economically disposed of in small euthanasic institutions supplied with the proper gases. A similar treatment could be advantageously applied to the insane, guilty of criminal acts. Modern society should not hesitate to organize itself with reference to the normal individual. Philosophical systems and sentimental prejudices must give way before such a necessity. The development of human personality is the ultimate purpose of civilization, unquote. So here we see the Nazi practice of setting up small euthanasic institutions, unquote, basically forecast and in a very, very accurate fashion by a French-American working for the Rockefeller Institute, of course. Obviously, the Rockefeller Empire, a very, very major power bloc in the United States, and one which, as we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and the first two Radio Free America shows, one which intersects with the Third Reich and which helped supply economic and political support to the Third Reich. We're going to take a musical break now and then come back with the second installment of tonight's broadcast. Welcome once again to One Step Beyond, and again we're in the process of downloading some information for the archival purposes. We're dealing this evening with the origins of the Nazi euthanasia program, how the Nazi euthanasia programs led to the overall Nazi extermination programs, and in turn, how those programs not only relate to the situation in the United States today, but how they relate, how they were connected with and grew out of mainstream international intellectual, political, and cultural traditions, namely the international eugenics and international mental hygiene movements and their advocacies of euthanasia. Returning now to the book, which is providing the bulk of the information for our broadcast this evening, this book, The Men Behind Hitler by Bernhard Schreiber. If we look back at the numerous paths the various currents of activity took in the first three decades of the 20th century, we see that in the 30s, they gradually amalgamated and a trend emerged in a certain direction, sterilization of the mentally ill, Nuremberg laws, etc., which was striving to, quote, even greater heights, unquote. The German racial and mental hygienists had prepared the ground for an all-embracing project which they called the euthanasia program, unquote, but would more accurately have been called mass murder of mental patients, unquote. In 1921, the professors Dr. Erwin Bauer, Dr. Eugen Fischer, and Dr. Fritz Lenz jointly published the first edition of their two-volume book, Human Hereditary Teaching and Racial Hygiene, unquote, which was internationally recognized as a standard textbook and was even used in universities abroad. In the second volume by Dr. Lenz, first professor for racial hygiene in Germany, the chair was established in 1923 at the Munich University, entitled Human Selection and Racial Hygiene, or Eugenics, he wrote, quote, "A real restoration to health of the race cannot be begun without generous measures in the organization of social racial hygiene. But these are mostly only introduced when the racial hygienic idea has become the popular knowledge of the population, or at least of the mental leaders. These must first develop a feeling for the senselessness of a civilization which allows the race to decay, an order of society and economics which has no regard for the interests of eternal life, which in fact is often detrimental. The introduction of racial hygienic education in the secondary schools, high schools, and universities could effectively counter this illiteracy or lack of education. Unfortunately, this will only be possible when the importance of racial hygiene has become known in the right places. As long as this is not the case, the most important practical duty of racial hygiene is the private promulgation of racial hygienic ideas. As soon as racial hygienic conviction has become a living ideology, then the racial hygienic organization of life, even public life, will happen by itself. Anyone who loves his race cannot wish for it to fall into decadence. He must realize that the industriousness of the race is the first and unrelenting condition for the thriving of the race. Even the fight for freedom and self-assertion of the race must, in the final instance, serve the race. When in a fight for power, the best blood is sacrificed without substituting it, then it is senseless. And when racial damage has been caused through war, be it through error or because it was inevitable, it must be the first concern of those who do not want to see the race blind but seeing, to even out these damages. This is not just the substitution in number. Much more important is the substitution of racial fitness. Even this requires the spirit of sacrifice, and fortunately, there is no lack of this. There is only a lack of understanding, unquote. And then the author goes on to say, a brief look at the professional and ideological background of both of the authors of the first volume proves very interesting. Bauer and Fischer had both worked devotedly in the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, Human Hereditary Teaching, and Eugenics, in which Ernst Rudin first acted as curator. Bear in mind, Ernst Rudin is the fellow who was associated with Wilhelm Frick, the Nazi Minister of the Interior, and the man who actually implemented the Nazi racial policies. Bauer, the biologist, later became the first Nazi rector of Berlin University, where Fischer later lectured as a professor for anthropology. Fischer, the other author of the book, Dr. Eugen Fischer, Dr. Erwin Bauer, and Dr. Fritz Lenz, the first three names we're looking at here. In his debasement of knowledge, Fischer sank to the depths of praising Hans F. K. Gunther, the author of Racial Knowledge of the German Race, who was a popular target for general ridicule even in Germany before the Nazis promoted him to a university professorship. Late in 1941, Dr. Otmar Freiherr von Verschuer, V-E-R-S-C-H-U-E-R, Nazi professor and former colleague of Bauer, Fischer, and Rudin in the above-mentioned Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, supported the Bauer-Fischer-Lenz textbook with warm recommendations. Verschuer was the founder and first director of the Institute for Hereditary Biology and Racial Research at Frankfurt University, opened in 1934. Even if it produced nothing else, it brought a further star into the Nazi sky. Verschuer's former assistant, Dr. Josef Mengele. From this position, he later advanced to be one of the most infamous doctors in the concentration camp at Auschwitz, where he conducted experiments with living and fully conscious prisoners and tortured the camp inmates for the benefit of scientific advancement, unquote. At the 12th meeting of the International Federation of Eugenic Organizations held in 1936 in Holland, Verschuer appeared as the representative of his institute together with Pletz, Rudin, and Fischer. One of the papers read to the meeting was by fellow delegate Professor Karl Astell from Himmler's SS Race and Resettlement Office, the RUSHA. Now we're going to take a look at, we've looked at here, at how the Nazi euthanasia program grew out of the Nazi, of the German mental hygiene and eugenics movements, and how many of the key intellectual advocates of this, of the eugenics and mental hygiene movements, even before the Nazi Party was in existence, went on to become key officials involved or intellectual heavyweights involved with the Nazi extermination programs. Now we're going to take a look at a very, very key incident, which was to serve as the moral, legal, and intellectual base for the Nazi extermination programs. A couple who had a very, very badly deformed child wrote to Hitler for permission to have their child put to death. And the couple's name, as a matter of fact, was Naur. This is a very important case. K-N-A-U-E-R. They wrote to Hitler for permission to have their gravely deformed child put to death. Hitler then wrote back granting them that permission. And this letter served as the moral, intellectual, and legal pretext for the Nazi euthanasia programs, which in turn were to result in the broader Nazi extermination programs. Again, we're now going to talk about the Naur case, a very, very important case in the development of Nazi extermination. Continuing with the men behind Hitler. The next step, towards the end of 1938 and the beginning of 1939, was publicly tested in Germany after endless discussions and propaganda moves. A letter addressed to Adolf Hitler, written by a man called Naur, K-N-A-U-E-R, from Leipzig, asked for permission for a doctor to shorten the life of his child, who was born blind, seemed to be an idiot, and had only parts of its arms and legs. The child itself was at this time at the Children's Clinic in the University of Leipzig, which was headed by Professor Werner Cattell, C-A-T-E-L, professor for neurology and psychiatry at the same university. At that time, Cattell was already an exponent of euthanasia and has remained one to this day, which fact he acknowledged in his book, Border Situations of Life, Contribution to the Problem of a Limited Euthanasia, unquote. It was Cattell who made the suggestion to the father, or at least focused his attention in that direction, to write a letter to the Führer. As an answer to this letter, Hitler sent his physician, Professor Karl Brandt, to Leipzig, and after consultations with Cattell, put the child to sleep. Several months later, Hitler signed a document authorizing Dr. Karl Brandt and Reich leader Philipp Bühler, B-O-U-H-L-E-R, to permit euthanasia in special cases. This authorization was supposedly signed in October of 1939, but was backdated to the beginning of September of the same year. The document was really nothing more than an authorization and formulated in such a way that a doctor who truly felt bound to the Hippocratic Oath could interpret it in such a way that no one would have to die. The Führer Order, as it was generally called, had apparently come about after a lively discussion between Dr. Karl Brandt, Dr. Leonardo Conti, C-O-N-T-I, and Dr. Philipp Bühler, and which was as follows, quote, Reichsleader Bühler and Dr. Brandt, M.D., are charged with the responsibility of enlarging the authority of certain physicians to be designated by name in such a manner that persons who, according to human judgment, can upon most careful diagnosis of their conditions of sickness be accorded a mercy death, signed A. Hitler. In spite of this, the document was regarded not only as a legal basis for the crimes committed by the psychiatrists of Nazi Germany, but later at the Nuremberg trials and in other court cases, it was used as a justification where the accused attempted to interpret this authorization as an order. Let me reread that last sentence, and then I'm going to expound on this a little bit here. In spite of this, the document was regarded not only as a legal basis for the crimes committed by the psychiatrists of Nazi Germany, but later at the Nuremberg trials and in other court cases, it was used as a justification where the accused attempted to interpret this authorization as an order. There are two key things here about the Naur case. In one sense, it served to focus public opinion in the direction that the Nazis wanted. In this case, to the extent that it promoted a favorable viewpoint of the idea of euthanasia. It was in some ways similar to the Fritz Haarmann case that we looked at in our program on the Pink Triangle, which focused public attention in a direction which suited the Nazis' characterizations of homosexuality and the gay rights movement as deformed, perverted, as a disease in the state, and so forth. Also, one of the things we looked at in the program on the Pink Triangle was the way in which the purge of Ernst Röhm, whose SA had become a threat and a rival for the army, was justified on the basis of anti-homosexual grounds. Röhm was a practicing homosexual and very forthright about this, and his homosexuality was used as the false pretext for eliminating him. The real reason, again, for eliminating Ernst Röhm was that he wanted the SA to replace the traditional German army. This conflicted with Hitler's long-term strategic goals in terms of conquering Europe. For this reason, Ernst Röhm was gotten rid of, but homosexuality was used as the pretext. The Night of the Long Knives, as it was called, the Röhm Purge, then became a very important legal cornerstone for the Third Reich, for it basically served to promote crime as an official and long-term instrument of the state. The Naur case promoted a different kind of crime, that of, quote, euthanasia, unquote, as a permanent, long-standing institution and policy of the Third Reich. Now, one of the dominant considerations in determining who was eliminated was their potential worth to society, and here the SS concept of useless bread gobblers is front and center. Again, reading from The Men Behind Hitler. In his book Into the Darkness, Nazi Germany Today, Lothrop Stoddard, S-T-O-D-D-A-R-D, an American social Darwinist, racist, and pro-Nazi, had the following comments to make after a visit to Germany where he had looked into socialized health in the eugenic courts. He states that in a conversation with an earnest young man who was officially in charge of the tuberculosis section of the Public Health Service headquarters, he was told that, quote, the treatment given a tuberculosis patient is partly determined by his social worth. If he is a valuable citizen and his case is curable, no expense is spared. If he is adjudged incurable, he is kept comfortable, of course, but no special effort is made to prolong slightly an existence which will benefit neither the community nor himself. Germany can nourish only a certain amount of human life at a given time. We National Socialists are in duty bound to foster individuals of social and biological value. Compare that assessment there with this particular paragraph from the Nat Hentoff column from the San Jose Mercury of April 3rd of 1986. This from Professor, or Dr. rather, Levinsky, Dr. Norman Levinsky of the Boston University Medical Center. Levinsky is also concerned about the effect of the AMA position on what he calls the making of medical decisions according to class. Quote, I have no question, he says, that some physicians and other caregivers consider the life of someone over 80 to be less worthy than that of someone who is 28. This approval by the AMA of withholding food and water could accelerate that kind of medical care. And again, the assessment in Nazi Germany was, the treatment given a tuberculosis patient is partly determined by his social worth. If he is a valuable citizen and his case is curable, no expense is spared. If he is adjudged incurable, he is kept comfortable, of course, but no special effort is made to prolong slightly an existence which will benefit neither the community nor himself. Germany can nourish only a certain amount of human life at a given time. We National Socialists are in duty bound to foster individuals of social and biological value. Obviously, a very close similarity. Basically, the operant consideration here is what in business is known as cost-benefit analysis. It's similar to when your car breaks down, you try to figure out whether it's still worth repairing it or whether it's you're just going to junk it and buy a new car. The Nazis were very effective in promoting a line of propaganda which caused their citizens to think of human beings in much the same value. We're going to take a look at the grim fruits of this particular policy, the Nazi euthanasia and extermination programs, and how they were instituted after a musical break when we come back with the next installment of tonight's broadcast. Well, welcome once again to One Step Beyond. We're going to now proceed with the third and final installment of tonight's broadcast, dealing with the Nazi euthanasia programs, how they grew out of the international eugenics and international mental hygiene movement, how they in turn led to the broader Nazi extermination programs, implications for today, and how many of these same individuals, many of the same doctors and intellectuals involved with promoting the Nazi euthanasia program and its intellectual underpinnings, were then reassimilated into the worldwide cultural and intellectual milieu which had spawned them in the first place, that is, reincorporated at the end of World War II. We're going to proceed now with the Nazi euthanasia program itself, called Project T4. Now, T4 stands for Tiergartenstrasse 4, that is the address in Berlin where the Führer Chancellery was located. The T4 ministry basically provided for all top secret Reich operations, one of which was the Nazi euthanasia program. Now, there are several key aspects to the euthanasia program to bear in mind as you listen to the passages I'm about to read you. First of all, the Nazi euthanasia program was accomplished under the auspices of Nazi psychiatry. The Nazi euthanasia program, their extermination centers were set up to appear like mental hospitals, and elaborate political fronts were set up to shield the Nazi euthanasia programs from the general public. The point here being, secrecy and pretense were a major, major element here. The Nazi euthanasia programs served not only to eliminate, quote, the life unworthy, unquote, or useless bread gobblers, unquote, but they served to spawn the broader Nazi extermination programs in two main ways. First of all, in the six Nazi killing centers under the euthanasia program, the techniques for mass killing were perfected. That is to say, the gases were perfected, the techniques for leading and maintaining control over the prisoners were perfected, and so forth. In addition, many of the people who went on to play key roles in the larger Nazi death camps, such as Auschwitz, got their training as mass killers in the six death centers for the Nazi euthanasia program. So the Nazi euthanasia program served directly to spawn the broader extermination programs in those respects. Returning now to The Men Behind Hitler by Bernhard Schreiber. Of the Nazi euthanasia program per se, he writes, "The Project T4 was fully integrated into the organizational structure of the Reich and fell under Section 11B, mercy death, unquote, of the Chancellery of the Führer, or KDF. It was divided into two departments, the administrative one headed by Philipp Buhler, B-O-U-H-L-E-R, a shadowy figure once described as one of the dictators of the dictators, and the medical section headed by Hitler's personal physician, Dr. Karl Brandt." Recall now, interrupting here, Philipp Buhler and Karl Brandt being two of the key people involved with the Naur case, the ostensibly merciful disposing of that badly deformed child, which served as the moral, legal, and intellectual justification, or jumping-off point, perhaps, would be a better way of putting it, for the Nazi euthanasia programs. Continuing with Schreiber's account. "In the middle of 1939, the end phase of the administrative preparations of the euthanasia program was started. It dealt almost entirely with keeping it secure and secret. The German people were under no circumstances to become suspicious, and the project was to roll without any interference. It was, therefore, necessary to disguise the activities as much as possible. Questionnaires had already been prepared by the psychiatric committee and advisors, and in October these were sent to the mental institutions of Germany. These questionnaires required answers to a number of questions, including name, marital status, nationality, next of kin, whether regularly visited and by whom, who bore the financial responsibility and how long in the institution, how long sick, diagnosis, chief symptoms, whether bedridden, whether under restraint, whether suffering from an incurable sickness or complaint, and whether a war injury or not, and what was the race of the patient. These questionnaires were prepared and sent out by one of the front groups which operated under T4. Now, there's a very important discussion here dealing with how the front groups for T4 operated and how the Nazi euthanasia program was rigorously screened from the scrutiny of the public. In classic psychiatric style, four front groups had been set up to shield the actual source of the operations in T4 from scrutiny. The idea being essentially that T4 itself would issue orders to the front group, who would then carry out the necessary measures. Anybody seeking to trace back the administrative chain, say from a hospital where patients were being taken to be murdered, would arrive at one of these four front groups, and the chances of getting any further back than that were very small. The front group which sent out the questionnaires, had them returned and handled them, was named Realms Work Committee for Institutions for Cure and Care. This became the headquarters for the whole of the organization and was started for this purpose. There was a parallel organization, another front group devoted exclusively to the killing of children, for obviously some specialization was needed in this area, and the front group catered to those who had knowledge and experience of children. It was known under the ambiguous name of Realms Committee for Scientific Approach to Severe Illness Due to Heredity and Constitution. In association with these two organizations were the Charitable Company for the Transport of the Sick, which transported patients to the killing centers, and the Charitable Foundation for Institutional Care, which was in charge of making the final arrangements. The decree of the Reich Ministry of the Interior of August 18, 1939, which introduced the requirements for registration of deformed newlyborns, unquote, was a great advantage to the Children Project. At first, this applied only to the children up to the age of 3, but after 1941, this project included the youths up to the age of 16. These four cover organizations safeguarded the Project T4, the Reich Chancellery, and the Euthanasia Committee from unwanted discoveries. Those who took the initiative were very secure, and if anyone had attempted to retrace the administrative chain, let us say from an institute whose patients were moved to killing institutes, he would probably have reached one of the four cover organizations. The chances that he would get much further were very small. Ironically, the relatives of the patients were charged with the cost of the killing, without, however, being informed as to what they were paying for. The questionnaires, having been sent out, were completed by the psychiatrists, doctors in charge of the patients in the asylums. When the questionnaires came back, they were evaluated by members of the psychiatric and professional members of T4, who were mainly leading professors of psychiatry in German universities. Those last two sentences again. The questionnaires, having been sent out, were completed by the psychiatrists, doctors in charge of the patients in the asylums. When the questionnaires came back, they were evaluated by members of the psychiatric and professional members of T4, who were mainly leading professors of psychiatry in German universities. The whole business was in keeping with the euthanasia program in that no one was ever actually examined in person in direct violation of any normal medical approach or standards, especially when one considers that life or death hung on the decision of the psychiatrist evaluating. Processing of the questionnaires was done very rapidly. For example, one expert, between November 14th and December 1st, 1940, evaluated 2,109 of them. At the beginning of the euthanasia program and for some time during it, Jews were very carefully excluded from amongst the people who were being accorded a blessed release from their sufferings. The reason, apparently, was that such a worthwhile fate was obviously not to be given to Jews, that only Germans could benefit by such a humane death. That the euthanasia program was such a haphazard stab at resolving the social problem as an emergency measure was shown by the approach and organization of the whole thing. At the time the questionnaires went out, perhaps even earlier, a number of mental hospitals or convenient buildings were being converted for their later use and were to be the killing centers and schools for murder. Death chambers were erected in the buildings disguised as shower baths and crematoriums, both of which were identical to those later to be established in the Jew killing centers in Poland. There appear to have been six principal death institutes and murder schools, and these were Grafenegg, G-R-A-F-E-N-E-C-K, Hadamar, H-A-D-A-M-A-R, Hartheim in Austria, H-A-R-T-H-E-I-M, Brandenburg, Bernberg, and Sonnenstein, S-O-N-N-E-N-S-T-E-I-N, the hospital of the super-expert Dr. Nietzsche, N-I-T-S-C-H-E. The system seems to have worked in the following fashion. On the basis of the replies to the questionnaires, the institute from which they had been returned was notified that a number of patients were to be moved, allegedly to make available beds for the war wounded or to be moved for better treatment. A number of reasons were made known or put around as the reason for removal. These patients were collected by the front organization Charitable Transport Company for the Sick, which then took them to one of these killing centers where they were exterminated within a few hours of their arrival. As a further camouflage, they were not always taken directly to the killing center. On some occasions, they were taken to an intermediate hospital where people were led to believe that they were there to be placed under observation. The total number of victims of the euthanasia program is difficult to determine, but as there were 300,000 to 320,000 mental patients in 1939 and only 40,000 in 1946, it would seem that the figure of 275,000 deaths mentioned in the Nuremberg trials was reasonably accurate. The victims were not confined to mentally incurable patients. As the program progressed and gained momentum, other undesirables were included. It was obviously too great an opportunity to be missed to not include anyone else who wasn't worthy of life. Amongst those caught up in the dragnet for the murder institutes were psychotics, schizophrenics, patients suffering from infirmities of old age, as well as epileptics and other patients suffering from a variety of organic neurological disorders, including the various forms of infantile paralysis, Parkinsonism, multiple sclerosis, and brain tumors. We also know that children were disposed of similarly when the orphanages and reformatories were searched for further candidates. It should be borne in mind that according to one expert, at least 50% of the patients murdered would, if allowed to survive, have been able to recover and lead useful lives. As we have seen, T4 went into a great deal of planning to disguise its operations and those of its killing centers as ordinary mental hospitals, and this was testified to in the Nuremberg trials by Victor Brock, B-R-A-C-K, the chief of the whole Section 2 of KDF and therefore one of the main persons responsible for the smooth execution of the euthanasia program. Again, these killing centers disguised as ordinary mental hospitals, continuing with Schreiber's account. At the Nuremberg trials, he testified, that is, Victor Brock, testified that patients walked calmly in with their towels and stood with their little pieces of soap under the shower outlets, waiting for the water to start running. I have been able to find more material on some murder institutions than others, but the following account could be taken as fairly representative of the other five murder institutions. Hartheim was situated near Linz, which was in turn also close to Hitler's birthplace in Austria. It was an old castle dedicated as an asylum to the poor, feeble-minded, and stupid in 1898. Hartheim, in company with other institutions, not only served as a murder institute for the disposal of mental patients, but also functioned as a murder school for personnel. That's staff personnel. That last sentence again. Hartheim, in company with the other institutions, not only served as a murder institute for the disposal of mental patients, but also functioned as a murder school for staff personnel. The medical directors in charge of Hartheim were two doctors, Dr. Rudolf Lonauer, L-O-H-N-A-U-E-R, an Austrian who later became an expert in 14F13, of which we will hear more later, and Dr. George Renno, R-E-N-N-O. They took their orders directly from T4 and were responsible for the medical, unquote, training of personnel. The training of staff was designed to harden the personnel psychologically to the experience of having to exterminate and observe the deaths of tens of thousands of people day after day, week after week, apart from any technical training they were given. That last sentence again. The training of staff was designed to harden the personnel psychologically to the existence of having to exterminate and observe the deaths of tens of thousands of people day after day, week after week, apart from any technical training they were given. However, from later activities in the operation of the death chambers and crematoria, it was obvious that they were being schooled for bigger things in the workings of the Third Reich. Most of the personnel concerned in these later activities had passed through one of these murder schools. The administrative official in charge at Hartheim was Captain Christian Wirth, W-I-R-T-H, a former policeman who had been selected by T4 to supervise the training. Apart from being places for disposing of unwanted mental patients and to train personnel, these institutes also provided scientific testing grounds for the perfection of the murder techniques as devised by the psychiatrists on the euthanasia committees of T4. The deaths of the victims were clinically studied, photographed, and perfected. In the war crimes trials that took place after the war in Germany, it was proved that in the death camps of Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka, special photographers also took pictures of people being gassed, just as they had at Hartheim and the other institutes. In addition, experiments took place with various mixtures of gases in order to perfect the most effective ones. During these tests, psychiatrists with stopwatches would observe the dying patients through the peepholes in the cellar door which served as the gas chamber in Hartheim, and the length of the death struggle was clocked down to 1/10 of a second. Slow-motion pictures were made and studied by the psychiatric experts at T4 in Berlin. People's brains were photographed to see exactly when death had occurred. Nothing was left to chance. The psychiatrists were very thorough. The actual training of the students proceeded in an orderly progression of familiarization. At first, they watched the experiment as observers. As their training progressed, they graduated to participation in the actual murders by conducting the patients into the chambers, releasing the gases, watching during the death struggle, and finally ventilating the chambers and removing the bodies. The selection of the students was conducted by the high-ranking Nazi officials who were personally and directly responsible to the Führer Chancellery. The whole operation was shrouded in very tight security. Everybody involved realized that there could be no slip-ups, there could be no leakage of information, because they weren't dealing with subhumans and Jews. These victims were Germans and Austrians, and the reaction of the public would be very strong. And in fact, when the program later became obvious to the inhabitants in the vicinity of the murder institutes, there was an outcry against it. Obviously, after so much familiarity with the deaths of the victims, the students became insensible to the cries and pleas of the murdered. In the process of their being hardened, the students were observed closely by their teachers, who noted their reactions and made reports on the progress as on their progress as pupils. If the students were able to observe and participate in the murders of their own nationalities, even though they were deformed or mad and were German or Austrian nationally, how much easier it would be to do the same to subhumans. Those last two sentences again. Obviously, after so much familiarity with the deaths of the victim, the students became insensible to the cries and pleas of the murdered. In the process of their being hardened, students were observed closely by their teachers, who noted their reactions and made reports on their progress as pupils. If the students were able to observe and participate in the murders of their own nationalities, even though they were deformed or mad and were of German or Austrian nationality, how much easier it would be to do the same to subhumans, unquote. Students who didn't complete the course because they cracked, couldn't go on with it, or were unsuitable were sent to the war front, where the commander in charge of the unit would assign them to a suicide squad. This would account for the lack of people with conscience willing to come forward to testify to what they had been involved in. The total number of victims at Hartheim is difficult to estimate, but at the Dachau trial in 1947, testimony was given that from 30 to 40 unwanted humans were treated in the cellars every day. As Hartheim was in operation for about 3 years, that would account for about 30,000 people. Hartheim also had another purpose. It served as a safety valve when executions taking place in nearby concentration camps such as Mauthausen and Dachau became more than the staff could manage. Victims were sent to Hartheim and dispatched, unquote, there. Later, towards the end of the war, Hartheim became just another place for extermination, its staff and personnel having been assigned to other duties. It was well situated for use in the euthanasia program, lying near a railway, but not too close, and around the castle there were a few little houses and farms. It was 17 kilometers from Linz, and from there only another 23 kilometers from Mauthausen. Schooling of the personnel produced perfect murderers who were used to the smell of burnt flesh, had been taught how to trick people being led to their death, and how to steel themselves against the crying and pleading of the victims. Pupils were naturally rewarded not only with alcohol and women, which were always kept handy for them, but also received medals. Usually these were the Iron Cross Second Class, and unlike other awards which had noted in the register the reason for their being given, in these cases, Geheime Reichssache, Secret Reich Matter, were noted in the appropriate column. So again, the significance here being that of the Nazi euthanasia program, not only was it itself serving as an intellectual breakpoint from which the systematic extermination of human beings could become accepted, but it also was used to perfect the techniques which were later used in the larger extermination camps. It also was used to train the personnel who later played key roles in the larger death camps. So again, the Nauer case, in which the little girl, the deformed little girl, was granted the right to die, was the key intellectual, moral, and legal point of departure for the Nazi euthanasia program, which in turn grew out of the German eugenic and mental hygiene movements, which were in turn closely connected with the mainstream intellectual and cultural movements around the world, the International Eugenics Movement and the International Mental Hygiene Movement. And then again, out of the Nazi euthanasia program, the techniques and the personnel to result in the larger Nazi extermination programs were graduated, and in addition, the euthanasia program grew out of the Nauer case and served as the intellectual causeway to the larger Nazi extermination programs. Should be noted here now, too, that just as the Nazi euthanasia program grew out of a mainstream, or two really, closely related mainstream intellectual and cultural movements, by the same token, many of the same personnel involved in instituting the Nazi euthanasia programs were very easily reincorporated into those same intellectual and cultural movements after the war. Although we're going to take a look mostly at the integration of advocates of euthanasia into British mental health functions after the war, the same thing happened in the United States, and this is instructive for our purposes. Again, the techniques, the Third Reich itself was not an aberration, and the euthanasia, the extermination techniques which they used, grew directly out of intellectual, cultural, and political traditions which affect us to this day. With the program, get the tape recorder running again. The next section we're going to look at from The Men Behind Hitler deals with the reincorporation of many of the same people from the German eugenics and mental hygiene movements and the Nazi euthanasia and extermination programs, their reintegration into the international eugenics and mental hygiene societies. It's worth noting here, too, that a name that we've encountered in the past, Sir Montague Norman, will figure prominently. Sir Montague Norman was chairman of the Bank of England. We took a look at him briefly in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and in Radio Free America number 1, the first part of looking back from 1984, the hidden history of the Cold War, we took a look at not only Sir Montague Norman's financial support for Adolf Hitler, but his political sponsorship of Neville Chamberlain, which is interesting in light of Neville Chamberlain's political concessions to Hitler at Munich and so forth. Of the reintegration of veterans of the German eugenics and mental hygiene movements and the Nazi euthanasia programs into the international eugenics and mental hygiene movements, Bernhard Schreiber writes as follows. Another personality who was questioned during the preparation of the same Dachau trial, that is to say the trial of physicians at the physicians involved in the euthanasia program, was Dr. Werner Villinger, V-I-L-L-I-N-G-E-R, who has been credited with being instrumental in starting the mental hygiene movement in pre-war Germany and restarting the same movement as a mental health movement after the war. An eminent psychiatrist who, 2 years after Hitler came to power, had advocated the sterilization of patients with hereditary diseases, he was convinced that... Let me start this again. An eminent psychiatrist who, 2 years before Hitler came to power, had advocated the sterilization of patients with hereditary diseases, he was convinced that the roots of what we call temperament and character lay in the inherited constitution. At the time of his questioning for the Limburg trial, it became known publicly that he was implicated in the euthanasia murders in a prominent and very active role. He went into the mountains and committed suicide. A former colleague and assistant of his, Dr. Helmut Erhard, in an obituary published in the journal Der Nervensart, The Nerve Doctor, explained Dr. Villinger's sad demise as an accident and with much sorrow regretted his passing and mourned the loss for humanity of such a wonderful and humane man. More on Dr. Villinger, again, a key person involved both with starting the mental hygiene movement in Germany and with the euthanasia programs. Some of Dr. Villinger's post-war activities are as follows. Dr. Werner Villinger had, after the war, become a world-famous psychiatrist. His specialties included juvenile delinquency, child guidance, and group therapy. He was also professor of psychiatry at Marburg and a very important member of the WFMH. He sat on the U.S. White House Conference on Children and Youth. The conference of the WFMH on Health and Human Relations, which took place in Hiddesen near Detmold, at Hiddesen near Detmold in 1951, he was co-chairman together with Rees. By the way, WFMH is a world mental health organization based in Britain. Dr. Rees is Dr. John Rawlings Rees, the psychiatrist who examined Rudolf Hess after his landing in Britain during World War II. In 1952, he was a member of a WFMH group on educating the public which met during the annual conference in Brussels. Doris Odlum, O-D-L-U-M, late member of the Eugenics Society, and Miss Appleby, already mentioned, were chairman and secretary, respectively, of the group. So again, Dr. Werner Villinger, among other things, sat in on the U.S. White House Conference on Children and Youth, this after having been involved in starting the mental hygiene movement in Germany and participating in a key way in the Nazi euthanasia program. And again, we're going to take a look at the reintegration of the German eugenicists, mental hygienists, and euthanasia program veterans into the mainstream international eugenics and mental hygiene movements, much as the Nazi spy organization under Reinhard Gehlen was incorporated into the Western national security establishment at the end of World War II, much as many of the key financiers and industrialists involved with the international cartel system were placed in power at the end of World War II as well.